Hey there, listeners. Before we hop into today's episode, we have a quick announcement. And if you are listening to this and you are in the city of Nairobi, Kenya, boy, do we have news for you. On April 26th, that is Friday, April 26th, we'll be collaborating with the Connect Experience for a fantastic networking mixer happening at Art Cafe Britam Towers. The aim of this is to bring together different young people in Nairobi and in Kenya generally who are enthusiastic about tech and a lot of the revolutions that we're seeing in the tech industry and a lot of other industries around technology, and more so young people with the interest and passion of networking and connecting with one another together in one room on this day. The Border Battle team will be in the house, Connect Experience team will be in the house, and so will a number of phenomenal panel speakers who we'll have on that day. And the tickets for this event go for 1500 Kenyan shillings. Now get this, these tickets are redeemable for your food and drinks. The money you're paying for these tickets will go straight into ensuring that you have a fantastic experience. You can find more information about this event on our Instagram page, as well as the Connect Experience Instagram page. That's at The Connect Experience. Guys, we have been so excited to finally be able to meet our listeners physically and interact with you guys and learn from you and be able to pour into each other's cups and so have the Connect Experience. And so we really hope that you'll be able to join us on the 26th of April. Tickets are 1500. Check out more details on our Instagram and on the Instagram of The Connect Experience. Now, that said, let's hop into today's episode. Our guest today is committed to enhancing people's lives by empowering them to recognize their inherent greatness. Mark Paulson is the president of People First Operations, Inc., helping leaders understand their people's strengths, motivations, and goals, and then aligning them with processes that fit their needs and abilities. From a very early age, Mark has always had an insatiable curiosity, often taking things apart to find out how they work. He went on to apply this same kind of analytical mindset in other aspects of his life, from the communities and spaces he engaged with, to his 30 years of leadership experience in the high-tech industry. In this episode, Mark unravels the intricacies of hiring processes from his experience in the tech world, and illustrates the transformational leadership models necessary to create work cultures within an organization that contribute to sustainable growth. We also delve into the qualities that hiring managers look for in an ideal team player, such as humility, hunger, and high emotional intelligence skills, and why it is so important for young professionals to be intentional about excavating themselves to understand who they are, what abilities they possess, and how to position themselves for opportunities that await them. Join us for yet another masterclass episode that bridges the gap between the complex hiring processes in the job market and empowering individuals to thrive within them. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages. Thank you so much for stepping into this space with us today. My name is Boniface Omina. I will be your host for today. It is a beautiful Tuesday evening here in Nairobi, and I'm joined with a guest on the other corner of the world. We find out just how far away he is, but it's a beautiful start to the week. It's been a lovely month of March, and I spend most of my day, you know, just enjoying this period of time as a graduate, where you don't necessarily have too many work responsibilities, not too many family responsibilities. And I think I'm stepping into this conversation feeling very well rested, feeling open-minded, and, you know, curious to hear some fresh perspectives from today's guest. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd love to introduce you to Mark Paulson. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be here today. And it warms my heart to hear that you feel well rested after graduation.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful thing. That's a good time.
Thank you. Where are you currently calling in from, and how's your day been? How's your day starting?
Yeah, the day is starting here. I'm a big fan of Dr. Andrew Huberman. And so my day started off on the back patio getting my morning sun. preparing for this podcast, and it's a beautiful sunny day. It's going to get up to about 62 degrees here in Boulder, Colorado.
Oh.
That coming after we had quite the blizzard over Thursday and Friday last. We got about 18 to 20 inches of snow, and it proceeded to melt rapidly. So there's far less snow today, and there will be even less still tonight.
Even less. I remember the snow in Boulder. It was no joke.
No joke.
For our listeners, you and I spent a semester at the Walton Institute in Boulder, Colorado, during our first gap year out of high school. And the beautiful thing about today's guest is we have a lot of overlapping networks, and that just makes this conversation a lot more wholesome. And we know exactly who we're going to be sending this episode to once it's out. But as we get into this conversation, Mark, we usually do an introduction before the episode. You know, we'll play it back and you listen to it once it's out. But a very easy question to get people to understand who you are is, if you were to meet a 10-year-old today, right, and they were to ask you, "Hi, Mark, what do you do?" How would you describe the work that you do today in a simple way to a 10-year-old?
Yeah, that is a great question. The work that I do today involves helping people live their best lives, which is kind of a phrase that gets used a lot, by helping them understand what makes them great and what makes them special, helping them find their superpowers. You're a 10-year-old, you know, superheroes and their superpowers. I help people figure out what their superpowers are and understand how to use them to help other people and help themselves. And so that's what I do. It's a fun calling.
Beautiful. I'm looking forward to unpacking that over the course of this conversation.
Sure.
Before I joined this recording, I was watching one of my favorite shows. It's called Avatar: The Last Airbender. And I like rewatching it because it takes me back to a point in time of my life where my family and I had moved from Nairobi, Kenya to New Jersey, right? Because of dad's work. And I was changing environments, going from being one out of 50 other Kenyan students in class to being, you know, the only Black kid in class in my school in Lyndhurst. And I think the adjustment at that time for me was quite difficult. But I found places of inspiration and learning and escape in a lot of the things in my immediate environment, things I used to watch on TV, the books that I used to read. And this environment provided a cushion, but then it also provided a learning platform for me as a child. And a lot of my perceptions about things like life, love, friendship, leadership have really been intertwined, and I can really tie them back to this foundational period of my life where I was searching for inspiration. And they've really greatly contributed to the person that I am today and how I approach life and my outlook on life. And I'd love to understand how this looks like for you. For someone who's meeting you for the first time and listening to you on this podcast, what would they need to understand about your early childhood experiences and environments and places you're in, better understand who you are today and the work that you do?
That's a good question, Boniface. So my early childhood, from the earliest time, I was a pastor's kid. I was born when my dad was in seminary in a very cold area of the country in Minnesota. apologies for that. Being a pastor's kid was definitely, it was something that I felt was a privilege to be, and I was honored to be my dad's son, the leader of this church or the churches that he served. And thankfully, I think pastor's kids get a rep of being either way off the deep end or skating the narrow, the thin, goody two shoes. And I would say that I was neither. My parents never made the church or his job a reason why I had to do something or be a certain way. They were just always for me and cared deeply about me. And that's how they parented. So I never felt like I didn't want to be a pastor kid. So that was helpful. I think part of my early childhood that informed what I did in my career was I was a kid that wanted to take things apart a lot. I wanted to know how they worked. And I just had a knack to dive in. And I think my mom found me with a screwdriver a time or two when I was 2 or 3 years old, and I was trying to figure out what I could do with that screwdriver and get at light switches and outlets and stuff like that. So that was definitely a significant part of who I was. But I have a similar experience like you, Boniface, in that we did live in the Midwest for the first 10 years of my life. And then my dad took a role at a church in Rhode Island. Now, it's not the same as moving from Kenya to New Jersey. That is crazy. But I went from this rural German farm town to a part of the country that's 85% Italian. Everybody's seems to be related to each other, and I do not speak like them at all. I'm speaking like somebody with a North Dakota accent, which if you've watched the movie Fargo, you've heard it. Moving to Rhode Island, where I had a hard time understanding what most of the people would say when I moved there. It's actually much more like New Jersey than anything. But it was enough culture shock to give me whiplash. I was in sixth grade at that point and didn't have any friends, and that's a tough time for a kid to move for sure. And I, like you, kind of dove into stuff I could do myself. I still had some friends, but I ended up having the best academic year of my of my childhood because, you didn't really have the distractions and
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
So all of a sudden I went from kind of, and I will say this too, I think the academic rigor in North Dakota was a little bit greater than what it was in Rhode Island. So I thought the classes were easy. I thought my school was easy. And I became the teacher's pet, and he would look at me and he'd go, "You're already done with what I asked you to do, right?" And I would just shake my head, nod my head. Yeah, I'm done. And so he'd give me more stuff to do, or I could do fun stuff. So I kind of learned at that point that it was good to assert yourself and really create focus and work hard. So science and math were my favorite things, always my favorite things. I had a particular affinity for electricity and magnetism. I don't know why. It turns out later on in life that that would kind of surface as part of the gifts, talents, and strengths that I was made with. I always wanted to be an astronaut. I read lots of books as a kid and saw astronauts floating through their spacecraft, and I wanted to do that. And so if you'd asked me then, what do you want to be when you grow up? I would have said that. And also recently, it was funny, I remembered playing with Tonka trucks. I don't know if you have ever seen a Tonka truck. Basically, Tonka trucks are these toy versions of big lifted trucks with big tires. And the whole point of Tonka trucks is to roll over stuff. You just like, as a kid, you're all through the mountains. Yeah, all over it, all over the Matchbox cars, you name it. It's kind of the like the monster trucks, only kid size. So here I am in Colorado, and now I have a lifted Jeep with big tires. And it never occurred to me that actually that harkened back to my childhood. So go figure. The only other thing I'll say is that my dad, though he was a pastor, he was technically minded and kind of on the forefront of high tech. And so in sixth grade, he bought a Commodore 64, which for you guys that don't know are is a, one of the first computers that was available for personal computing. And 60 it had 64K of RAM. So your phones now today, you're buying phones with 128 gig, 256 gig of memory. This was 64K kilobytes of memory. And he would use it to, do word processing, which today is Google Docs, or and he'd make he'd type his sermons in there, and he'd create the bulletins for church. Well, I got a hold of it on all the other days that he didn't use it, and I started buying programming magazines, and I started writing basic programs in the Commodore 64 when I was in sixth grade, and just sort of learning how to code then, even though most people didn't know anything about coding. And so that, again, would serve me well later on in my career.
Wow.
And I was just a kid.
I was just a kid,
just
right?
You fun. Know? Yeah, I just like to have fun.
I
play
love
with
that.
My friends. Yeah, so.
I love that. My dad got us a computer as well at the house, and I was on it like almost all the time. I reckon a lot of the computer skills that I managed to pick up early were just based off of just having that piece of equipment in the environment. It's just lying there. Interesting. Mark, when I eventually came back to Kenya and found myself in high school here, I joined this mentorship organization known as ACAD Education Group. And it really opened my mind to the possibilities and different possible career opportunities that I could find myself in. And I think that just goes to, like, that's an ode to the kind of influence that our environments play in us, but then also the kind of influence that the people in our environments play in us, you know, mentors, people like that. And stepping out of high school when I was trying to navigate university, and even now in the stage that I'm in after graduation, I can look at the world around me and consider the different factors that are influencing my decision, right? How is the world of work shaping up? What does financial freedom look like for me as a young man in Nairobi, right? What do opportunities outside of Kenya look like because of where I've gone to school in AOU, and so on and so forth, right? I'd love to understand how the world around you looked like when you were my age, Mark. What kind of key factors and considerations guided your early career decisions? And are you able to identify certain people who played a role in this transition season that you're in at my age?
Oh man, that's a great question too. I wish I could say that there was someone who really took a vested interest in my career decisions and my choices. But I think I was going on what I knew, what I was interested in, right? So many students are coming out of university or going into university from high school going, well, I like this. My gut says I should go study this. And, when I meet with parents today, and I just met with a set of parents who have a 21-year-old and an 18-year-old this week, and I said, you're dealing with six figures that you've saved up or that you will contribute to your child's education in the next 4 years of college. Do you want to gamble on their gut, or do you want to make a better data-driven decision? And I didn't. I did not make a data-driven decision when I was your age. I was looking at the world, right? Computing was starting to ramp. And I saw some stats this week that said there were 5 million software engineers in the world when I was probably your age, or thereabouts, 5 million. So there's high demand for software engineers. And I went through university and I got an electrical engineering degree, and I focused on computer engineering in particular, and did a co-op job when I was in college and wrote some code for, essentially it was a government agency for the United States, and learned that I could write software and get paid for it. And that was kind of cool. It didn't, however, make a ton of sense from my own gifts, talents, and strengths, though I did like software development. And there are some aspects to software development that I am good at, but it didn't completely use my gifts, talents, and strengths as God made me. So I wish that I had had a guide that had come alongside me and said, we're going to figure out what you're great at, because your life and your career is going to be much better if you use those God-given talents and gifts for yourself and for others. And so I have a funny story, and I'm happy to tell it now if we have enough time.
Yes, please, go ahead.
Okay, so here was the thing. I went into university, I declared myself mechanical engineering major. I know that my brain works mechanically. I just, you know, I going back to childhood, I took things apart to figure out how they worked. And I couldn't necessarily always get them put back together again correctly, but I would figure out how they would work. And so I thought, you know, mechanical engineering seems like the thing for me. I'd love to work on those Tonka trucks, design those Tonka trucks or whatever. And so I got to school. I did my first year as a freshman, took a bunch of, you know, the gen ed requirements. And I was with my best friend, like you and your best friend would have gone probably around in the summertime between school. And we ended up at a comic book shop. And he loved comics. So we stopped in there. And the guy behind the counter had a WPI sweatshirt on. I went to Worcester Polytech in Worcester, Mass. And I saw this guy, he was, you know, had a sweatshirt on from my own school. And I thought, wow, that's kind of interesting. Here's a guy from WPI at a comic book store. And I went up to the desk and I said, oh, did you go to WPI? And he goes, yeah, I graduated last year. And I was like, interesting. What was your major? And he said, I was a mechanical engineering major. And I said, interesting. And that was that. I left the store and I got in my friend's car and I said, I'm going to change my major. Just like that. And he's like, you are? And I said, yep, I'm probably going to go electrical engineering. And that's exactly what I did. I made that decision based on some interesting data points that I interpreted to mean there aren't many jobs in mechanical engineering, and I'm probably not going to be the top 10%. So I might not be one of the ones that gets the job, and I might end up in a comic book store. So I changed my major sophomore year. Keep going, Bonifaz. Did you want to say something?
I was gonna say that's like the crazy data points you're using, Mark. You're gambling.
Oh, I know. For real. Yeah. So changed my major, went into electrical engineering and went the computer engineering route. And here's the interesting thing. I started to take obviously my major classes in my sophomore year, and I sat there and some of them made a lot of sense. Some of them didn't make a lot of sense. You're in university. I mean, you're learning new stuff. And I got into a set of classes called electromagnetic fields, 1 and 2. And these two classes tended to be ones that students really did not enjoy. And I was sitting in these classes and I'm like, I love this. This is so fun. I don't know why I just got it. All the equations made sense. There are complicated equations. I'm not like the most gifted mathematician, but in this case, E&M fields 1 and 2 made a ton of sense. And I didn't have a guide next to me going, well, you know why that is? It's because you think in three-dimensional spaces in ways that other people don't. And when I learned that later on in life in 2009, I thought, wow, I wish I had known that when I had chosen my major, because I probably would have stayed mechanical engineering, if I'm going to be honest. Three-dimensional thinking somehow just is one of the superpowers that I have. So I could have gone that direction in electrical engineering. I could have gone towards electromagnetic fields and power, and I could have used those strengths in my choice, even in electrical engineering, but I didn't know. And so I kept going in computer engineering, and it served me well, the things I could do. And I made a career of it for almost 30 years. But I won't say that for those 20 years later that I worked in software development, that I was necessarily using the things I was great at. And so anyway, it's kind of a long story, but it makes a difference when you know what you're really good at. And I would just encourage the listeners, if you don't know, take the time, find someone who can help you and really figure out what you're great at, because you're great at some things and you might not know. You might just think everybody else is great at it, and it's not the case.
I think that's one of the things that people have a very difficult time reconciling, what you just mentioned earlier of the fact that we'd go through an education system and then find it difficult and or impossible to translate either the knowledge base or the skill base into our work life. Because when we begin school, that's what we're told, right? You're studying to get a job and so on and so forth. And that can look differently for everyone in terms of what the outcome of school is. But I know like a lot of people who are listening to this conversation now are sitting with themselves, you know, trying to navigate that kind of decision-making, wondering whether did I do the right grade that will match the opportunities in the job market. And I remember we had a conversation with one of the advisors on our podcast. His name is Steve Cardigan. He was LinkedIn's first chief HR officer. And his episode was on careers as a laboratory of experiments. And he encourages people to really try out and test their strengths out and skills out, exactly what you just said, in as many fields and industries as you can, even if just for the sake of learning about yourself and building that awareness and that confidence in who you are and what you can deliver. And I'd love to understand, Mark, what is the fallout of that university experience, right? Changing the major and now stepping to the workspace. How did you manage that transition in? And can you speak to any feelings, emotions, or thoughts that you were having at the time? And where did you go to seek comfort at that time? Did you fall back on your faith? Are there certain people you fell back on? Are there some lessons that we can weave through that, you know, that transition season after uni?
Good question. Yeah, all all throughout college, as far as my faith is concerned, the reality was, you know, that's the first time you're away from your parents, and all of a sudden you're faced with, okay, is this faith that I grew up with in my parents' house my faith? Is this something that I truly believe? And I had gone through some of that in high school, to be honest. So when I got to college, it was kind of the next step in that journey. Like, is this mine? Am I owning this? And thankfully, my university had a group on campus called the Navigators. And so I jumped in with the Navigators, and they started to really disciple me to knowing Jesus better and to making him Lord of my life. And so as I navigated my major field of study, and I ended up doing this co-op job, part of my brain is strategically oriented. And I thought, you know, I better come out of the university with some real world experience. And so that's why I decided to take a semester off. It wasn't really a semester off, but use my university's resources to get a co-op job at a local company and get some real world experience, because I knew that that would help set me apart from other candidates coming out of university that didn't have that. So they actually would bring companies on campus for seniors who were graduating. And I was able to interview with some of those companies, and one of those companies jumped at offering me a job. And so I went to work for them. It was basically my first software development job. And I worked for a guy named Mike, and I loved working for him. He was a great manager, albeit he was an engineer, so he was a little bit introverted, we shall say. And so I just saw God open up these opportunities for me to meet folks that would play a significant role in my life later on. And so I think when you go to university, even if you just graduated and you're like, shoot, I didn't know what my superpowers were and I didn't pick a major based on that, it's okay. You know, God has had a hand in where you are right now, and you're right on time. He's making a way for you. And the older I get, and the more I see that playing out, not just in my life, but I have five children, and I didn't get a chance to tell you guys kind of who I belong to. I'm definitely God's first and foremost. And then my wife, Beth, I'm the luckiest husband on the planet with her. And then I have five amazing kids, three girls who are now married to three amazing men, and I'm so thankful for my son-in-laws, and then two young men who are both in university now, and I see God working in their lives, and it's just awesome. So when you get to walk and journey with the Lord every day, know that he's ordering your steps, even though your steps might feel real windy. That's been the theme of this year for me is, boy, my steps feel really clumsy and windy, and I don't know that I'm doing the right thing at any given time. And then I see how God was just ordering my steps in a perfect way. And I think, oh my goodness, I had no idea, but it was his will, and he's for me. So I think going back to your question of how did I navigate these transitions? It was in faith. And it was also with a can-do mindset where I showed up and I was like, I know I'm not perfect, but I'm gonna try my best to learn this system. If I was in a new job and learning the processes of how they do things and what we're doing and just leaning in and being humble. There's a great book called The Ideal Team Player. And I think for anyone getting out of college or even in college, to read that book by Patrick Lencioni would be a huge win. Because as a hiring manager, and I've hired a lot of people over the last 10 years, it really highlighted to me what I actually was looking for in those interviews. And it wasn't the things that normal hiring managers look for, which are hard skills. Can you do this? Can you do this? Tell me about this. What was this? It's more around what is the ideal team player? It's someone who's humble, hungry, and smart. And that smart part isn't like intellectual smarts. It's more about emotional intelligence. Can you relate well with other people? Can you participate on a team as a humble and hungry person, right? And all three of those influence each other too. And if you head to the back of the book, he unpacks, what does it look like to have someone on your team who's humble and hungry, but not smart, or who's humble and smart, but not hungry. And, you know, you start to look at these profiles, and I've seen them in business. I've seen them in industry. I've even seen them on my team, and you go, yeah, that's a blow to the culture. When you have someone who isn't all three, you're kind of going, ugh, how do I navigate this as a manager? And so read that book. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Be humble, hungry, and smart, and go where God leads. It's an amazing journey.
I think this is a beautiful time for us to segue into the work that you do, right?
Sure.
As we're doing our research on people-first operations, you have a very interesting two-step approach, which I feel like you've hinted at already, where mm-hmm. it's encouraging, or rather, not just encouraging, but training leaders and managers to know their people mm-hmm. and then maximize on their processes. Mm-hmm. Could you walk us through how this two-step process looks like, or rather,
yeah,
one, the relationship between knowing people and how that translates to maximizing processes. Uh-huh. And how do you, from what you had begun saying, as a manager, what lens do you begin sort of knowing your people, right? And understanding yeah. who the talent that you have in order to influence operations.
Sure. Can I share my screen? Is that all right to do on the podcast?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah? Okay. So it's actually morphed a little bit. That know your people to maximize your processes. That is definitely the full circle, but I've been iterating on this a little bit more recently, and I just want to share this diagram that it's actually now more of a four-step process, if you will.
Oh, that looks interesting.
So basically, the first step is still know your people, right? And I don't know, is it big enough for you to see?
Yeah, it's good, it's good.
Okay. So this is where, when as a leader, as a manager, maybe you've asked to take a team that exists, or maybe you've been asked to staff up a team, which I've been asked to do both those things, and it's an interesting set of unique dynamics when you do either or of those. But either way, you want to start at step one: know your people, know your employees, get to know them. This is actually true for parents. This is true for teachers in a classroom. This is true for any leader in any situation. Get to know your people. And in that process, make sure you establish trust and psychological safety with them. Because if you don't do that, you actually don't get to know them. You get to know a fake them. You get to know the them that tells you what they think you want to hear for as long as it suits them. And that's really not getting to know them. But if you establish trust and psychological safety through modeling the way and your own vulnerability with them, which oftentimes can feel a little weird, especially in the workforce. If you're a leader and you're kind of opening up about some of the things you're feeling insecure about, or your weaknesses are, but you can do it in a way that allows appropriate levels of vulnerability that really helps to cement that trust and psychological safety with the people you're leading. And then you learn about their strengths, their talents, their superpowers, their passions. And I would go one step further and say even their calling. I think we all have a calling in life that flows across who we are as people in all the areas that we are as people. And if you can get to the heart of the calling and the motivations for why they do what they do, that really helps you know someone. And again, couple assessments that I use in this process, and for your listeners, I'll tell you today, the two assessments that I use are Gallup's Clifton Strengths. It used to be called Strengths Finder. Now it's called Clifton Strengths. And I also use alongside that a framework called Core Clarity. Go to coreclarity.net. You can read about that. And Core Clarity really takes my opinion and the opinion of quite a few people I know and respect. It really takes the top five results from the Clifton Strengths and makes it super actionable. As an individual who knows your own strengths, but also as a leader who knows the strengths of their team. So really get to know your people from there. And you have to start there in order to get to step two, which is I want to maximize my people. I want to be completely for them. Another book, The Motive by Patrick Lencioni. This is, if you have that motive that he talks about in that book, in knowing your people to then maximizing your people, you're going about it the right way. And spoiler alert, the motive is love. So you want to maximize the people that you're leading in their strengths, in their talents. You want to motivate them with what internally motivates them. They will feel seen and known and heard by their leader when you go through these steps. And as a leader, like I always wanted to have a way to establish a customized growth plan and growth path for each person on my team. It's so important that we let our people know, our employees know, hey, I'm for you and I'm for your growth path. I want you to succeed in the work world. I'm going to give you opportunities to better yourself, aligned with your strengths, so that you're passing me. Like, I want you to go past me. Like, go for it, right? So you get to maximize your people. When you do that for your folks, you're going to get people that want to work with you forever. They will say, you're the best manager I ever had. And it's an amazing thing to hear that. For me, it was a sad thing to hear that because I had been managing this team for about 6 months It was my first management opportunity. I'd managed this team for 6 months, and a guy who was about 50, 52 years old, he came up to me and he said that to me. And I was really sad. I was really sad. It didn't hit me like, wow, that makes me feel really good. And my head got really big. I got really sad for somebody who had been in industry for that long, and some guy who had only been managing for 6 months was the best manager he ever had. Like, that should not be. That is just wrong. So that lit a fire in me to help others. So maximize your people then moves into really knowing your processes. So I could come into the team as a manager and I could go, all right, unpack for me all the ways that we get work done and skip one and two. And what's going to happen is the teammates that I'm now the manager of are going to go, here we go again. We got somebody in here who thinks they know better than us. And we get missed. We aren't known. We aren't understood. We aren't seen. He's going straight for the processes. And he's going to make a bunch of changes that we're going to hate. And this place is going down. So you don't have to do that. Know your people to maximize your people. And then you get to see your processes through the eyes of your people, who are in the right place, in doing the right things, aligned with their strengths. Maybe not my strengths, right? So I want to see these processes through their eyes. Tell me what you're seeing. Tell me what is working. Tell me what isn't working. Tell me, how would you make it better? And so that's when we get from knowing through the lenses of the right people doing the right things into maximizing your processes. And now I'm delegating the authority that's been given to me, the scope of influence that's been given to me, to my teammates, because I know them and I trust them and I want to better them. And they are all on board. Like, we're going to go crush it. We're going to go win as a team. We have a leader that is totally for us and is letting me flex my super strong muscles that maybe I didn't even know I had until he showed me or she showed me. And now all of a sudden in step four there, you're seeing massive productivity gains, massive well-being gains, massive amounts of, like, people who maybe weren't A players before. They were kind of struggling because they were in a role that didn't use their strengths and gifts and talents. And now you've been able to see them for who they are and find the gold inside of them. I tend to use that phrase a lot. It's like, people are like gold mines. We want to find the gold inside as fast as possible so that we can put them in a place where they shine, right? So you find the gold inside and then you move them into a role or give them projects where they can use those gifts, talents, and strengths where it makes no sense not to, right? So we leave a lot. I see this happen again and again in corporate America. The manager doesn't take the time to do number one. They don't necessarily have the motivation to do number two. They jump right to number three, and then they get apathetic, disengaged folks because, you know, maybe they're not motivational. But when you are for your teammates, that is intrinsically motivational for them, and they are going to love it. So does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense, Mark. And I was just about to ask whether, and you mentioned corporate America, I was just about to ask whether there's certain kinds of organizations or industries where this works well. Say, for example, smaller teams where you can create a more intimate environment to be able to build that psychological safety in and trust in step one, and then take a team through all that. But I could see certain companies which would prioritize that because maybe of how big the company is, or that's just not, you know, what their inherent, you know, company goals are. Have you had any experience with training or coming across managers who are either stuck in their ways or just don't see how this is applicable, and how do you navigate that from your perspective as a coach, in terms of getting them to see the value of this or a practical way to apply it?
Yeah, I see it all the time. The kind of the classic thing, especially in high tech engineering realm, is who do we promote We typically take the A player who's been crushing it in some engineering role, and we say, "Hey, you're fast tracking. Like we want to keep you. We want to keep you engaged. Do you want to manage this team?" And they're like, "Okay." I mean, we throw a lot of dollars at them. They say yes. And then the management training we give them is they come, they get some time with HR, and HR says, "Okay, you now have all the permissions and all the systems. You can approve time cards, you can approve time off, you can do performance reviews. Here's what's expected of you for performance reviews, and you're blessed to go manage." And they're like, "Okay." And now they're supposed to lead meetings. They're supposed to lead people, and they don't know how. And I was there. I didn't know how. I was asked to manage this team, and I was given a lot of actually very kind things in that process, where the manager, the VP and the director said to me, "We believe you have the right people skills for this. We see how you're already a great leader, and so we'd love for you to staff up and lead this team building this brand new product that no one had ever built before." So I didn't know how to do that. And I thought, okay. And the question I asked was, am I doing this the way that I know it should be done, or am I just a pass-through manager doing it the way you want me to do it? And they were like,
Incredible question, Mark. Come on. What do they
and
say?
they said, "No, we see in you what we want as a manager, so go do it your way and we'll support you and we'll be here if you have any questions." And I was like, "Okay, yeah, I'll do this." And I had been burned once before in a leadership position, and so once bitten, twice shy, and maybe that's what causes you to ask questions like that. And so they did. They supported me. Oh my gosh. There have been many times, Boniface, where I have thought, should I ever have left that? Like, that was so good. It was such a good place for me to be. And we did, in 4 years, we built this crazy product that is so cool, and it's won awards. We did like three or four major releases and added tons of features. So I wore a lot of hats. I learned a lot of things about ways that I can show up and help a team. But really, there was number one priority. Number one priority always for me was my people, my employees. And so yeah, I think that what happens is we train people in the management nuts and bolts, but we don't equip them with leadership. And that's where I want to give people a North Star for leadership that doesn't fail them in the storms, right? It's like, you're in the middle of a storm, like this is the direction you still head. It's know your people, maximize your people, to then know your processes and maximize your processes. That this will not fail you. And I can promise you that, because I have a lot of war stories where this has been my North Star. And I'm thankful that I've been able to finally put this down into a diagram that I go, yeah, no, this is it. This is totally it.
You simplified it really well in the diagram as well, Mark. And when in our final year, I think it was last semester, our last semester of university last year, we did a module called Leading Organizations in Something Something Change. And we were comparing the difference between leadership and management, right? How management is ticking boxes, but the leadership, for example, is knowing which boxes to draw and just how to basically manage people and be able to inspire people. And in that lesson, on the leadership side, we learned about different leadership styles and so on and so forth. But what really stuck out is the fact that whether or not you believe leaders are born or made or trained or whatever, there are those fundamental differences that will always stick out. And it will stick out in the outcomes and in the results that you see if you approach something from a managerial standpoint instead of a leadership standpoint or vice versa. And I think as a student at that time learning this, and we just the work experience that I have so far. I love that in your first step of knowing your people, you put psychological safety, because that is important in any kind of situation where you're trying to lead a team. As you're going through the diagram, I was like, I hope Yuri's taking notes as our podcast manager. Because there's certain aspects of that we see in some of these small teams that we lead as entrepreneurs. And shout out to Yuri for the phenomenal job that he does. And I think young people listening to this right now, I think it also puts us in a position where we can look at our managers and our leaders and criticize them according to some of these frameworks, and let that also guide not just maybe the career decisions that we're making, but then also understanding what kind of managers that we want to be when we carry on with our career. So thank you so much for sharing that, Mark.
Yeah, of course. No, this is part of my calling. My calling is it really at a bedrock level, whether I'm parenting or I'm involved in ministries at our church today, I want people to thrive in using what God has given them to his glory. And I want them to be able to do that in perpetuity. I don't know if you've read any of Simon Sinek's books, but he has a book called The Infinite Game. Fantastic book. I love it. He has so many case studies and stories in that book that are so worthwhile reading. And they have, in some ways, influenced this framework for me. Because really, what's the point of business if, and he makes this point in the book, you'll hear certain companies say, we're number one. And you'll hear other companies say, we want to bring elegant technology to the lives of others to help them live a fulfilling life. And you'll never hear them say, we're number one. Because in the game of business from a video game theory standpoint, it's an infinite game. It doesn't end. It's not a finite, like we're gonna win and we'll be number one. No, you're gonna maybe be number one for a little while, but then what's next? Are you gonna go out of business? You're gonna keep going. And so do you make decisions as a leader that helps your people do this in perpetuity? And so one of the things that I'm working with an organization that's so near and dear to my heart, I'm helping them with their employee well-being. And they have seen their employee well-being scores kind of dropping in the last few years, which most companies admittedly have had because of what we've gone through with, COVID and lockdowns and masks. And don't get me started. There's a lot we could talk about. We should do podcast number two on all that. But I came alongside this company because the VP invited me in. He's like, let me tell you what we've been doing. Let me tell you what we've been struggling with. And oh, by the way, our well-being numbers are, kind of going down. And I left that meeting and really God kind of woke me up in the middle of the night one night. And he goes, Mark, there's a big red light on their dashboard. The engine is still running and the car is headed down the road in the right direction and they're accomplishing the mission, but that check engine light is on. And if they don't do something about it now, they're going to be broken down on the side of the road and it might be game over. So I came back to him and I said, listen, I'm worried about this. I think you need to take the opportunity right now to address this. And I kind of laid out a workshop and it was a 3-month, 3-phase thing. And we're in the middle of it. And it's so interesting meeting weekly with his leadership team because really it's all about the leaders first, which I love that. By the way, it's like you guys probably came to this thinking that we were going to maximize the well-being of your people, but it starts with you. So let's go. And so it's been really fun to work with them. And the conversations that are opening up and people are feeling safe to share, because that's what this is all about. Safe to share what's working, what's not working, what we should keep doing, what we should change doing. And it's a beautiful thing when you open up that space and the upper management is there going, no, this is really important. And we care about your well-being. We don't want you burned out. Because there's a lot of bad side effects that come from burnout. And I lived it. And I didn't know quite how burned out I was a year ago. until I took the opportunity to start People First Operations. And most people, I think, go into starting up their own company with their hair on fire, working as fast and furious as possible. And God really told me to slow down and learn the unforced rhythms of grace. And it's been super restorative for me to be able to set aside large blocks of time and really focus and write. I'm writing a book. The book, by the way, spoiler alert, is all around this diagram that I shared.
Come on.
You'll be able to hopefully get it on Amazon at some point. And So
that's beautiful, Mark. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think one thing that really sticks out for me is how your work is rooted in your faith as well. And that was the main theme of the previous conversation that we had with Jason Tucker. His episode is actually set to drop tomorrow. Spend most of today working on his episode. Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned your book, and one of the last questions I was going to ask you is, are there any exciting projects or initiatives that you're working on that you'd love to share? Aside from the book, or if you'd like to speak more about the book or share something else, the floor is yours.
Oh, thank you for that. Yeah, this book is it's a passion project. It actually started quite a few years ago, and I'm not a published book author. So this is definitely a growth edge for me. I'm a big growth mindset guy. I love Dr. Carol Dweck and her work. And by the way, that influences my own hiring practices. When I'm hiring people, I'm looking for the ideal team player and someone who is excited about growing into the role that I'm hiring for, as opposed to someone who could do it in their sleep and they're going to come in and they're going to be pretty bored straight away. I think that hiring managers get that wrong. So we go into a lot of this actually in the book, because I don't want the book to be ethereal, pie in the sky theory, and someone comes away going, I don't know how to apply this tomorrow or even in the next meeting. I want them to read this book and feel like, oh my goodness, there is so much to implement. Like, I have to pick what I'm going to do this week, and then you can make that a habit and pick the next thing the next week. So this is going to turn into a book series. The first book is all about really unpacking the base fundamental framework, which then is going to lead into another book that's called The People First Operational Leader. And that will have a lot of rubber meets the road stuff as well. And so this book series, I'm hoping, will be helpful. There's amazing books out there. I don't claim that this is new or unique in any way. It's probably a rehash of other things that other people have written that I haven't read yet, or some that I have read. And but it's just kind of my framework that has clicked and resonated with me over the years. And so that's one thing. I have a service that I call Launch, and Launch is all about, number one, know your people, and leads then into maximize your people. So Launch is for, I've kind of put it in business terms, there's three personas that Launch is for. Launch is for the 17, 18 year old who is in their senior year, like my son, who's going through Launch with me right now. And they're headed to university, or they're headed to high school graduation, and they're not really sure what they want to do. They're not really sure what they're good at or anything. So I take them through two assessments. Oh, I didn't finish. I started telling you about the assessments. The one is Clifton Strengths and Core Clarity. The second one is a more expensive assessment, and it's called Johnson O'Connor Research Foundation. You go to jocrf.org. You can read about Johnson O'Connor. You can read about how they've been doing this for 100 years. And they have loads of data. So this is where it's really important that you can make a data-driven decision on your career, because they're going to assess you. I call them Rain Man-like tests, where you sit in a testing center for about 7 hours, and they put all sorts of puzzles and things in front of you and have you do all these tests, and they really do tell you what you're savant-like at. and they give you the data as the results, and you have a later results meeting, and they provide you with those results. I did this in 2009 at the suggestion of a friend, and I had been laid off, and it was a layoff that was hard for my heart because I felt like it was targeted at me, and maybe there were some performance implications to the layoff, and it was hard for me to absorb that. Because I worked hard at this company, and a friend said, "Hey, you might want to go do this thing, Johnson O'Connor." And I was like, "Johnson, what?" And he's like, "I did it." He said, "It changed my life. It totally changed my life." And I got the results, and I took them to John, my friend, who I love, John. And he looked at my results, and he just started laughing, and he nods his head, and he goes, "I was a software engineer too. I took this assessment. My results look so much like yours." And he's like, "Now you know what I do." And he was a custom home builder in Boulder, building unbelievable, beautiful homes for some of the nation's richest people. So John was like, "You should become a home builder like me." And I'm thinking, I have 5 mouths to feed at home. I don't think so. So I didn't make any changes. But now, later on in life, I would do the Clifton Strengths, and I would have somebody named Bert Robinson with Empowering People come alongside me and really help me with the Core Clarity Framework to understand that assessment. And so this thing called Launch that I offer clients to go through is take these two assessments, Clifton Strengths and Johnson O'Connor Research Foundation. We bring them together. We have a whole bunch of dialogue with you and with your parents, if you're a young person, with siblings, with aunts, uncles, whoever was around and knew you when. We dig into your early childhood. We dig into those things that you did in middle school, high school that you found you loved. And then we also help you understand what is your calling in life. My calling is to help people live their best lives through understanding their own strengths, talents, through data. And their passions. But I have someone who I was taking through Launch, and he came to me and he said, "You know what? I figured out my calling. It's to bring people together." And when you look at your top five and we looked at his, I'm like, "Oh, this is beautiful. This is perfect. This is exactly who you are. This is exactly your calling." And I said, "Okay, so now that we explore these careers, can you bring people together with this career? And what would that look like? Or what about this career? What would that look like to bring people together in this one or this one?" Yeah, it's this holistic thing about who are you? What are you meant to do? And what's your gifts, talents, and strengths? And he's probably going to start his own company doing niche tourism, bringing people together on a vacation, doing stuff that, oh man, is so fun. And so anyway, so that's Launch. I have three personas, the 18-year-old, the somebody like you who graduated and you're like, "I have this degree. I'm not really sure what to do with it. But definitely my career is all ahead of me. And boy, I sure think that I would like to use my gifts, talents, and strengths, my superpowers in work and align it to some missions that I care about." So it's for the person who just graduated. It's also for the guy like me who worked in software development for 20 years, writing code. And I'm not going to say I died a little bit every day. That wasn't my experience in writing and developing software, but it wasn't a perfect round peg, round hole. It was kind of like oval peg, round hole. And and it was painful where it rubbed. And, you know, some people though are like, "I am dying a little every day. I hate sales, or I hate marketing, or I hate whatever, and I don't feel like I'm used at my full maximum. How do I get there?" And so it comes alongside the professional to give them new life and help them transition into a role that they can flourish in. Now, what was interesting for me is I was a software engineer one day. My boss, Dave, came to me the next day and he goes, "We think you should lead this team." And so I, you know, you heard the story. I said yes. And I moved into this leadership role. And then I found out that was a round peg, round hole. And boy, you know, 6 months later, some people are coming to me saying you're the best manager I ever had. And I'm thinking, why didn't I know this about myself? Why didn't I know that I could be a great manager where I'm not a great software engineer? And yet I marvel at and am so appreciative of those people that make it look so easy. And boy, there are some people I've worked with over the years where I just look at their code and I go, this is brilliant. Like, this is, how do you think like this? I can't think like this. My coding is point A to point B. I get it done. There's not a lot of abstractions or, like, you know, and these guys just think on another level, and it's a beautiful thing to behold. And so I get to call that out as a manager. I get to go, I need you on this project because I know we need to win on this project and you're going to crush it. So,
you know, your people.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So there you go. Those are some of the big fun things I'm offering these days. Launch for students, launch for professionals, the book. See where it takes me.
Yeah. That sounds super exciting, Mark. And I'll definitely recommend it to a friend, because I don't know how often Yuri gets this, but I guess quite often where people reach out to us and they look at the podcast and they look at a lot of the conversations that we have with people, and they reach out with some challenges. And so a couple of weeks back, a friend was telling me she'd been working a 9-to-5 job. She's looking to quit. She doesn't feel like she's being creative or tapping into her passion areas.
Yeah.
And I never managed to have a conversation with her because it was before I was traveling to Mauritius. I think I'll definitely recommend this episode. And I think even this episode launch, as well as what I'm coming out from this episode understanding, is to make some of these career decisions, you need to go back to the drawing board and just revisit yourself and build that self-awareness. Such decisions forward require us to look inward for it and fall back on our phone. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm with a group of guys that I think another guy we might send this to is Amar.
Yes.
And we call it excavation, right? Sometimes we do have to do that excavation of ourselves to dig up, like that Tonka, like the Tonka truck thing for me. I was like, I hadn't thought about this in, gosh, decades. And all of a sudden, one day, it was like God just went, hey, remember when? And this excavation of this little detail was like, oh my goodness, I do remember. And sometimes it's joy-filled and sometimes it's sorrow-filled, right? Excavation can take the shape of creating a lot of joy and nostalgia, or it can take the place where it's like, I need to work through some pain. I need to get through some of this because it's holding me back. And there's plenty of those things in my excavation journey as well. I wouldn't be here today talking to you if I hadn't done some of this excavation of myself, because I was not confident. I had pretty low confidence and self-esteem because of some stuff in my past. So you got to do the hard work sometimes to move forward.
100%. 100%. Yeah. Amar was our fourth guest of the podcast and you are 84th guest. So I'm happy that 80 guests between the both of you, and you guys are preaching the same message.
You guys are crushing it. I love Boardroom Banter. I love it. It's such a good podcast. Keep going. Yeah, you're inspiring a lot of people.
Thank you so much, Mark. And we've just reached the end of our conversation. And I think this has been a beautiful, it's been more of a reflective exercise than anything. You have me really asking myself the important questions. And I hope to the listeners, as you step away from this conversation, first of all, thank you so much for sticking with us this far.
My pleasure.
Yeah. And I hope you can take from Mark's story and apply into your life the things that you can. Hope you take the time to share Mark's story with as many people as possible. If you want access to some of the tools or information to some of the tools that he's mentioned, we'll put this information in the show notes. And let's all take the time to excavate ourselves and really discover what our calling is. Mark, you look like you've discovered your calling, and we thank you so much for doing that, because then you can step into the boardroom with who offers this much value, and it's been a phenomenal time.
I've loved it. Thank you so much, Boniface. You're a wonderful host.
And Thank you, Mark.
I'm praying for your podcast to continue to
make Thank you so here. Much. So our listeners, we'll see you on the next one. Bye-bye.
Hey there, folks. We're wrapping up today's episode with a quick one from our sponsors, Nepal Tea Collective. Nepal Tea is a social enterprise based in New York that distributes the freshest organically grown teas to different parts of the world, directly sourced from smallholder farmers in the beautiful country of, you guessed it, Nepal. We're proud to be sponsored by them, and at the end of our episodes, we like to wind down, and we cannot think of a better way to wind down than with a cup of hot Nepal tea. So if you'd like to check them out, go and look them up at nepalteacollective.com. That's nepalteacollective.com for more information. See you on the next one, guys.